good. It looks like I've missed some very good things looking around the walls, and I'm really glad there's a mandala on the shrine, actually. It fits with things I was thinking about today and that might come into what I'm offering tonight. I've not been to any of these. I've been off sick, actually, the last week, so I'm actually glad it's quite a small number and that you're all quite gathered, because I'm struggling to kind of speak a bit earlier, and I'm softly spoken anyway, so do go like that if you can't hear me. I suppose it is a talk, what I'm going to do. So I don't know that it's super structured with a sort of starter, main course and sort of dessert or anything like that. It's more sort of a tapas affair. And I was kind of reflecting today on things that actually have been useful to me in meditation, or things that inspire me, or things that mean something to me. And I couldn't be fagged to read loads of books and sort of come with a sort of proper sort of exposition of, I don't know, something from the sutras, really. But so I thought I'd talk mainly from my own experience and things that I've learnt off many people in my sort of meditative career to date. I suppose the main thing for me about meditation, actually, that's always really grabbed me is that it's a wonder that we're conscious at all. It's a wonder that we have awareness, that we have this sentient capacity to be awake. And in a way, I could shut up shop and leave it at that, because in a sense, it's the start and finish of meditation in a certain, from a certain perspective anyway, and it's about deepening into that quality. I thought I would attempt a kind of led meditation as part of the talk, actually. At first I thought I'd do a led meditation to not have to talk so much, and then I thought, well, why not kind of talk through it a bit more than I might usually do in a led meditation? Maybe by way of getting out a few kind of principles and stuff like that, and things that I might draw on later. So let's start with a little sit. And as I say, it might be a bit wordy and reflective. And I decided, as the theme was self-power and other power, I try and sort of almost introduce an element of both in. I'll end with something imaginal that I borrowed from Vasantra. I've been on quite a lot of Vasantra's retreats, which should bleed through a little bit of what I offer. And there's a thing he does at the end of his morning meditations, a period in the morning, which actually leans very much into other power, I think. And that will look after itself when we get there. Let's just take a minute to settle, and I'll lead us through a practice of, I don't know quite what to call it, but it'll be a practice. So just let your mind widen. Your whole experience relax. And see if you can let your consciousness sort of fall open into the space. Not doing that going in thing of centralizing into oneself, but expanding out. So letting your mind fall open into a big, big space. And see if you can without losing a wide field of attention. See if you can just notice your contact with the ground. Whether it's just your feet on your ground, your knees. Just bringing your quality of awareness downwards, lowering your center of gravity. Looking for sensations in the body that tell you the ground is underneath you. And notice any shift in the quality of awareness as you come into a sense of ground, into contact, into establishing yourself in the lower body. The spine rise up out of the pelvis, right up to the crown of the head. Maybe feeling a little bit of a pull of the vertical element, which should open up your chest a little bit. And taking a breath into the heart area. Notice the felt quality of your emotional center. And extending a kindly awareness to all your experience. Just letting yourself soften. Just deepening. Just widening. Just relaxing. And again, notice the quality of your awareness of your mind right now. Take in the fact that you are experiencing, you have awareness, you're alive, sentient. Sort of listening into that quality of aliveness. And let's take a minute to just reverence awareness, just reverencing awareness. Moving us into a bit of vipassana, a bit of inquiry. Sort of just floating the question, really. Where is awareness? See if you can find a location. See if your awareness, your mind, has any colour, any shape. See what you can find. Just floating the questions without getting too conceptual. And just to add another one in, can you sense someone who owns this awareness? Can you find an experiencer behind the experience? Have a look freshly. Don't assume. And notice the quality of your attention again. And if you tightened at all, just relax your awareness, let it go wide. Letting go of all the reflections and just sitting in open space. Reverencing one's own awareness and reverencing other awarenesses in the room. We're sitting here in the mandala of our practice community, sitting in the middle of Sangha. Also practicing within a mandala of practices. And let yourself be held by the fact that in this shrine room there's been thousands of hours of meditation. thousands of hours of metta bhavana. And then in imagination, widen your awareness beyond the shrine room. And just imagining a whole ring of lotus petals going round the shrine room, round the outside. Lotus petals of purity, encouraging us to blossom, to open. And outside the ring of lotuses, a ring of vajras. A vajra wall offering protection. The qualities of the diamond thunderbolt offering strength, clarity, a cutting through. Beyond that, a great circle of flames, transmuting samsara into nirvana. Wisdom flames, the fire of shunyata. The wisdom flames encourage us to see clearly, wisely, to not be fooled by delusion. They protect our minds. So we have our mandala and we take our seat at the centre of the mandala. We sit in the centre of the mandala with all the qualities of awakening, blessing us. Love, or the compassion, or the clarity, or the wisdom. And we just let that rain down on us. And just taking a few minutes to bring the meditation to a close, widening the mind, noticing how you're left, and coming back into more relational awareness. I know that was a very full practice, actually, and quite condensed, that I kind of wanted to bring quite a lot of themes in kind of all at once, if you like. But the first gesture of meditation really is simply that sort of turn towards our experience. It's sort of turning towards being conscious. It's that moment of sort of waking almost. And in a sense, if you can enter into that sort of undistractedly, I'm sure if you could keep that space open, it would blossom out and your mind would unfold in the way it's kind of meant to, according to the Dharma, pretty much. So there can be a lot in looking at, I was thinking about just being conscious and sentient and thinking, actually, I guess whole religions or points of view or kind of philosophies have grown out of just that act of turning towards awareness and what we make it mean. In a sense, I prefer just to see it as a mystery. It's something that's utterly ungraspable. We never know fully what it is. And the Buddha in his meditative experience, I suppose, went through lots of experiences and mistaking meditative experience for something that it wasn't at times. So you've got the Brahma Jala Sutra, I think, which has a number of wrong views in it relating to meditative states. And I think at some point it's worth kind of doing the study bit that goes along with meditation to do with how we can kind of make a particular space into meditation, conceptually into something it's not. But I'm not going to go there tonight. I'm just going to call it the mystery and almost that aspect of just waking up to your own experience and being curious about it, not being too quick to sort of close it down with concepts, actually, but to leave it very open and ungraspable, and certainly the mind or what awareness is ungraspable, or I think is very useful. In preparing for this talk, I got out. I like to write lots of things in notebooks, and I've got lots of little Dharma notebooks. I write down little thoughts or things that people say or whatever, and I came across a thing by Dilgo Khyentse, who, as most of us will know, is one of Bhante's teachers, and he has this sort of pith instructions for meditation, and it's about 10 verses, and I'll read you the first one. While mind is watching mind, though there is nothing to see, it is vividly clear. Unconstrued, free and at ease in that state, rest naturally, undistracted. And actually, if we can rest undistracted in a meditative state, we're doing very well. But as most of us know, distraction comes too easy and with our conscious control. And a lot of the follow-on verses of Dilgo Khyentse's pith instructions about thought and thinking and going forward in time to the future and this, that and the other and what to do with it. So, we'd like to be in that space, which sounds to me like a sort of pure just sitting space, actually. And actually, for most of the time, we're kind of not. We might get little glimmers. And I notice that people that have often been meditating a long, long time, very senior practitioners, almost start to do more and more just sitting, because that space, I imagine, opens a bit more naturally for them. But for most of us, actually, it doesn't make sense to sort of, we'll probably zone out or numb out or just become distracted. So, I was thinking about distraction and thinking, well, why do we get distracted? I guess the distractions are the hindrances, really, that sort of cover over underlying luminosity of mind, almost that luminous quality, that alive spark of awareness that we all have, that hopefully, you know, we sense when I took you into meditation there. A little quote from Basantra, actually, which I think takes in distraction in a sort of a way. He says, like, sitting like a Buddha would mean no fight with the arising and ceasing. So here you are, to sit like a Buddha, whatever comes, whatever arises, you don't really resist it, actually. There's no resistance to your experience. It's like it just sort of blows through. There's no sort of grasping after or pushing away. It can just come and go freely. I guess most of us fight with our experience quite a lot. I think we're quite frightened of our own minds in some ways, you know. And I think part of the reason we're sort of taken up with distractions is that we can be frightened of our own minds. Some of it can be obvious things like lifestyle, can't it? And being very busy and lots of things sort of bombarding us from sort of sounds and tellies and God knows what. But I think... there's also something about not being able to be comfortable with just sitting, being aware, actually. It's almost like we want something to fill ourselves, something from the outside to fill ourselves. It's that sort of dissatisfaction that reaches out. And I think meditation actually sort of brings you into that sort of space where you are attempting to sit with yourself. There's that story of the Buddha, isn't there, and the king, where the king says, well, what can you give me? You're a sort of poor, homeless beggar, really, and here I am with all my wealth. And the Buddha says, how long could you just sit and do nothing? And the guy, I think, says about an hour, and the Buddha says, well, I could sit here for a week or whatever and be perfectly content. It's that. The Buddha didn't need anything outside his experience to complete it. I think there's also something about when we drop down quite deeply into meditation, and certainly when we leave thoughts a little bit behind, when we're quite embodied and still, it can go a number of ways. For me, I often find it a relief. It's like I can put down all that I identify myself to be. I'm no longer a white, middle-class, boring sort of middle-class order member struggling to get through my workaday world. All those roles and sort of expectations and stuff that I might load myself with, I can just sort of drop. I can drop a lot of identity. And in a way, that's quite a relief. But almost as meditation goes deeper, I think when we go from the surface of our being quite deeply down, actually it can be quite frightening because there's less self-reference. It's like the mooring points of where we hang a self on start to dissolve. They start to become a bit unhinged. It's like there's no sort of things to point our compass at anymore that tell us who we are. And in that, there can be quite a lot of fear, and that can jolt us back up to almost like a more superficial layer of our experience. So I think in some ways that can be part of why distraction is, in some ways, can feel attractive. It's almost like we don't trust the mind enough to let it unfold in a way that would be good for us. Probably got a little bit highfalutin, so I'll bring it back down to earth a little bit. I mean, if you read things like Maitreya Banerjee's, I think one of his mindfulness books, or Like Living with Full Attention, he starts with basic things like knowing where your keys are and sort of, which is one for me, or sort of having a mindful walk or eating mindfully, or, you know, very basic things of bringing awareness to that happen in everyday life. And in a way, that starts to sort of orient the mind to not being distracted. So I think all those things are very useful, actually. I don't do them enough. I'm someone that's always losing my keys. I do sometimes sort of do a mindful walk, but what switches me on, actually, more is beauty. I was out the other day. I live in Ayrshire, and I'm on a little single track road, and I was out a little bit in the mist, actually, And in the mist, it's like the trees were coming out at me, and they all looked like they had individual personalities. It's all like they were sort of looking at me in a certain way, and they were bent in a certain way. It's almost like you could see the conditioning sort of bending them in the wind. And they were like little beings. And it was almost in that receptive, almost like poetic state, I was sort of imaginally kind of almost like resonating with them. And there's something about entering a more subtle way of being aware that often comes with the imagination, that takes us into depth. It takes us out of the surface of our being into something a bit more fluid, something a bit more receptive to how things are. I think the imagination is a very key route. And often to get in that zone, you have to spend quite a lot of time almost like putting life down a bit and just having a pause. I quite like watching clouds, actually. I think clouds are good preparation for meditation. It's like just watching the changeability of the sky. So there's something about when you drop down into something that I think of as almost like a poetic way of being, life becomes more meaningful. Because you've got your appreciative aesthetic awareness there. And it's almost like the world speaks back to you in a different way. Those trees were speaking back, waving at me in the way they wouldn't do if I was in my normal, what I call the clunky loca mode of being, which I'm all too often in. So, yeah. In meditation itself, I think dropping down to the subtle can be... I imagine everybody's here has probably had that experience of doing the mindfulness of breathing, and you think you've lost the breath, and all of a sudden you notice yourself breathing, and it was a bit like you hadn't lost the breath. It's just your mind had become so subtle that the object was very subtle. It was this sort of fine experience of the breath. Do we all know that one? I'm sure we probably do. And in that experience, it's often there can be a sort of quite a natural uprush of joy, and more something of aesthetics. Actually, it can feel like beauty. And there's a fella who was in the Thai forest tradition before he got chucked out for ordaining women. Yuck. Anyway, who called it Ajahn Brahm's the beautiful breath, and I really resonated with that, actually, the beautiful breath. So there's something about letting experience become subtle and beautiful. Right, I can't actually read my notes with my dodgy eyes. Okay. I thought I'd sort of shift, if I haven't already, to a bit of stuff about other power. For those of you at Parinirvana Day, I was talking quite a lot about Ananda, and I suppose I had quite a lot of reflection since, because Ananda, when the Buddha was dying, as we probably know, leant against a sort of post and wept because he was going to lose his master, who was so kind and had all this love for him. He was going to lose the Buddha's love and compassion and kindness. And he was absolutely bereft. And I was walking along my little lane again and kind of trying to imagine, and not the Buddha's experience because I can't, but I could resonate with Ananda's experiences, like losing your Kalyana Mitra, losing someone who holds that vertical dimension for you, losing someone that's going to kind of always be loving, always going to want your blossoming. And I was thinking, you know, because Ananda was with the Buddha day in, day out for donkey's years. And what would it be like to be in that presence of all that love? I mean, it would seep into your bones, you can only imagine. The Buddha's love would be almost overpowering at times. And I was thinking, well, you'd probably lose some of your ordinary kind of social neurosis, like what's he thinking about me? Or does he think my politics are a bit dodgy? Or does he think, you know, does he worry that I'm having a bad hair day, or I've shaved my bad hair badly, or something, you know? Or those anxieties that are often common in our lives, in the face of that love, I think just wouldn't be there. And there's something about doing the metta bhavana that leans us into that territory. But often when we come into learning the metta bhavana, it's very much in the self-power way, isn't it? We often start with the phrases, you know, may I be well, may I be happy, which is great, and we build something up. But there's also almost like if you're going to do it like imagining yourself to be Ananda, and you're with this being that just radiates love. There you are. You are in this mandala of love, and all you need to do is open to it. So like in meditation, it's a bit like floating the question gently in awareness. What would it be like to receive the Buddha's love? What would it be like to be in the presence of the great love of the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas? And seeing what happens, actually. Seeing what happens in the body if you imagine being absolutely unconditionally loved with a love that wants nothing but your own betterment for you at your best. It's kind of a bit of an other power way of doing the metta bhavana. So I thought I'd throw that one in. I think one other thing, in terms of meditation, in terms of other power, actually it can be quite good to start with a mantra. It's like spend a good 10 minutes doing a mantra, and not just concentrating on the sound of it, but the feel of where it resonates in the body, and almost like letting that become very subtle and taking you down into meditation can be a good way of almost like... The mantras sort of bless us in a way. They come from the Adhisthana, the blessing powers of the Buddhas. And almost like if you can kind of tune into that, it can be a good way of invoking other power, I suppose, in meditation. Right. I thought I'd move on to something... I used to do a lot, probably about 8 years ago in meditation. And it's around ethics. And as we all know, it's like meditation needs a good ethical base. And meditation itself is also an expression of ethics. It's like a, you know, in Bantu's term, it's a continuous state of skillful mental states when it's going well, at least on a good day. And I think there's ways in which you can set up meditation to make that more real for you, almost. And, you know, I've always sort of tended to begin meditation or begin practice with maybe a little ritual or some chanting or whatever. And I used to do the refuges and precepts, and it's very easy just to become mechanical with them. I don't know about when we saluted the shrine, how many of us was really here, really reverencing, saluting the three jewels, really taking, this is an opportunity to go for refuge. Or wherever we went, Namo Bunhaya, which is, often what I do, and I'm not decrying it, actually, but it has its effect. And I decided doing the refuges and precepts was having an effect, but I'd often, they weren't very fresh. So what I did was look at the positive precepts, but do them sort of meditatively. So it's almost like setting up a meditation, you know, getting that sort of preparation for meditation, and then just drop in, you know, with deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body. What does that mean meditatively? What would that look like as a meditative practice? Sort of coming into bodily awareness with kindness. It's like just thinking of a pint of Guinness sort of settling or something, you know, when it does that sort of movement, it's like suffusing your body with kindly awareness. And there you are, you've kind of entered the first precept, really. You've kind of entered the world of non-violence, of non-harm. Then you've obviously got the second precept, with open-handed generosity, I purify my body. And I really like the gesture of open-handed. And the Dharma is a lot about moving from this to that. It's this open-handedness. So you're opening in meditation. You're opening to your experience. You're kind of what I sometimes think of as putting out the welcome mat for whatever's arising. You remember the arising and ceasing, or whatever is arising. You're sort of offering a generosity to that. And I think what that does, the more you're able to open to yourself, is more you get sort of sensitized to the human condition. You get sensitized to what it is to be human, fully human. And the good thing about that is that it can lead to a sensitivity to other people. It can lead to a greater empathic awareness. In other words, you can be generous to others. You can lean out of yourself into others and offer that open hand of generosity out the way from a meditative place of coming to meet a lot of human experience within meditation. So, yeah. Hopefully if we've got to that point, and I do it quite slowly when I've done it, is you started to still. So it's like, with stillness, simplicity and contentment, I purify my body. So letting the mind coming into stillness, becoming more simple. I think sometimes we make meditation too complex. I know I made our lead sit very complex, but it was part of the talk, so I let myself off for that one. But often, actually, meditation should be very, very just open and bare, I think, can be very helpful. And out of that, if you're quite still and experience is simple, often there can be a contentment, and often sometimes there's sort of little subtle pleasures that if we lean into, builds greater concentration and greater contentment, actually. So you're quite happy to be there. And if you're not content in meditation, and sometimes we're not, let's face it, it's like, can you bring a sort of contented attitude to that? Can you just sort of, yeah, this is my experience right now, and I'm just going to keep solidarity with it? Yeah? Fourth one, with truth or communication, I purify my speech. I think what this means in meditation, this you talk out loud in your meditation, is almost a gesture of authentic relating to what's happening. It's like not being in denial about your experience. It's like turning towards it with as much truth bearing as you can hold. It's that gesture of, no, this is my experience, warts and all. Might not want it to be this way, but this is how it is. I think a very important thing in meditation is just being able to turn towards ourselves as we are. So, yeah, fifth one, with mindfulness clear and radiant, I purify my mind. And almost like letting the radiance sort of our minds just... what's beneath the hindrances, what's beneath all that distraction, just let that sort of shine through. I was watching the film Turner on the telly at the weekend, and there was these beautiful seascapes, but it also reminded me of, like canvases were really dear, so sort of old, I don't know if Turner did it, but lots of famous painters. There's another painting underneath, and it's almost like the front one could be the distractions, but almost like there could be something bleeding through from the depths almost. Mindfulness can give that quality of depth and almost like something can kind of roll out from that. Yeah. I think I won't go on much longer because everybody's looking a wee bit tired. And I'm sounding kind of more croaky, but... I thought I'd just point out, most of us will know these, I think, a few pitfalls, areas where we can go subtly off beam in meditation. And the first one, I think, is becoming mechanical, actually, becoming a bit habitual, losing creative mind, which is why I, that precept practice I stopped doing the refuge's precepts in a chanting way and made them very conscious because I'd become mechanical. So having a creative relationship with their minds. I was on a retreat with Vasantra in September, I think it was, and he said, oh, we take these practices that we're given and we murder them. And great, eh? Yeah. And what he meant by that is actually, yeah, we can become very mechanical. And I think part of it is that we can lose our intention in meditation, lose a clear awareness of our focus, what needs to happen. And part of it is that we can lose touch with the intention of the practice. There's a variety of practices, and they're all pointing the mind to unfold in various directions. You know, metta is obviously supposed to make us more loving, more kind. Mindfulness is obviously supposed to make us more mindful. If we're not becoming that, then there's something about, well, our intention, or are we aligned to the practice of the intention, and having a dialogue almost between the two. I think the second thing, and I'm very guilty of this sort of hitting the cushion running sort of thing, is a lack of preparation. And preparation can be doing absolutely nothing. But you have to almost like do a little bit of emotional Aikido in meditation sometimes. It's a bit like, how can you make the mind want to meditate? And sometimes that's not a challenge, and sometimes, as we all know, it is. So how can you feed it a bit of inspiration, or kind of make the hook attractive so it will bite, you know? And it's just like, oh yeah, I want to do this. And sort of knowing when you're wanting to meditate and knowing when you don't is an awareness practice in and of itself. Sometimes I think just cloud watching again, or doing something that has a subtlety to it, can encourage that sort of ability to drop into the subtlety of meditation a bit more readily. What can come up actually if we become mechanical, or we become a bit, you know, as with the last one I was talking about, is to compensate for this, we can become a bit driven, or I'm going to really grit my teeth and sort of do this practice. I used to do that a lot in my early days of meditation. You know, I used to really, sort of with the mindfulness of breathing, really sort of, you know, go for each stage with a vengeance, like I was hanging on a cliff face, and if I fell off, like, that would be the end of me. It was, and I got into quite interesting states doing that, and it had its day. But I think as things have gone on, it's like it's much more about relaxation for me, and actually just sort of opening, and a sort of gesture of, not a sort of tight kind of gripping to experience, but just letting it be as it is, really. So, you know, it just seems to be the way my practice is gone. The fourth one I've put here, which I think I can often be guilty of, is sort of being attached to results, that sort of thing of wanting to get somewhere. It's like grasping at the fruit of meditation before setting up the conditions for the fruit to arise, sort of thing. You know, you want to be this sort of wonderful Buddha-like character, but where the rubber meets the road often is something rather different, and you have to meet yourself where you are and actually engage with your experience as it is. And actually, it's that next gesture. If you think about it, our experience comes to us, you know, Pratitya Samuppada, there it is, it's dependently arisen, boof. You can't help that, actually, what's arising in the mind, you know, or the body particularly. I can't help being slightly croaky at the moment. But how I can respond to that is the thing that makes a difference. So it's like, can I have a creative response? Can I meet whatever's coming up for me, whether it's a croaky voice, sort of, you know, extreme lowness of mood, or sort of being really sort of rattled, with an appreciative, kindly awareness. So that response to whatever our experience is, The creative response is what Going for Refuge is about fundamentally. So your next act of body, speech and mind in meditation is what's crucial for getting your results. Don't worry about results. It's about trusting in the process and trusting that our minds unfold in ways that the Buddha kind of outlined for us. And all we have to do is get on the bus and do what we need to do, and actually the rest will happen naturally. Right. Oh, something else I should heed a bit more of my own advice here is after meditation, is giving a little bit of space between meditation and doing the next damn thing you've got to do. I can be guilty of hitting the cushions running. I've got this amount of time and I'm up and running at the world, you know. And that actually, sometimes that's the way it needs to be. But almost sort of sitting in that sort of slightly fluid zone, just open, relaxed, not doing anything in particular, I think is a very good thing. Leading on from that is, you're late. You missed it. Actually, coughing is an interesting thing. You kind of realise, really, that the body which you think your own has its own life. I have nothing to do with it. It just does its own thing. At the weekend, I was struggling to swallow. I was thinking I should be able to swallow. My glands were really swollen. And actually, the reflection that came with it is that actually, this body is not mine. It's not I. It's not really, you know, it has its own set of conditions rolling on. And they're rolling on rather unpleasantly right now. And can I respond kindly to that? At times, actually, I found it a bit challenging, it has to be said. Anyway, what I was going to say is not being too precious about meditation either. And something that helps with that, something that really helps with that, is something like the transference of merit that we do in the puja, or some act at the end of a meditative period of dedicating your meditation to all beings. It's like dedicating it to your day. It's like, may I go out in this day and be sort of helpful. May I be a sort of, you know, a bit like the Buddha meeting Ananda. I mean, getting a bit grandiose there, but you catch my drift. It's like, can I take this meditation out? And I think on that note, I'm going to stop, actually. I think that probably feels enough for a day that you've all had and a night that I have. But thank you for your attention, your kindly attention. Thank you.